for the 29th of March, 2017.
You can lord it over.
And what I'm going to do is open up an informational hearing on educational programs for the deaf and hard of hearing students. And I do want to let people know that we are under a time constraint. And so we have you going from 3 to 3:30, and so we'll have it from like 3, no longer than 3:40, because we have other business that we have to do. We're under a very tight timeline.
All right.
Okay, so with that, I will call up Chad Ludwig. I was looking at this one.
Yeah.
Denise Hackett and Cheryl Davis.
Where's Chad? That's the Chad.
Thank you and welcome.
And
make sure you identify your name for the record when you are testifying.
Eastern has a fabulous program.
Really? Chad's not here.
Okay.
Chad is in the other room. The other hearing room.
Yeah, we can hear you.
So it's just us. We can move forward, I think.
Great. Thank you very much for hearing us today. We appreciate the time that you're giving us. My name is Cheryl Davis. I'm the director of the Regional Resource Center on Deafness at Western Oregon University, and I was the co-investigator on the community needs assessment. This is Denise Fu Hackett. She is the principal investigator on the project, and she is also faculty in our rehabilitation and mental health counseling program at Western Oregon University. Denise?
Hello. I appreciate this opportunity to come and be here. I'd like to mention that there are a few of my students from the rehabilitation and mental health counseling program here. So they're watching their professor in action doing some work. So first of all, I think it's important for me to do some
self-disclosure. You do need to identify yourself for the record, please.
Oh, my apologies. Dr. Denise Fu Hackett. Thanks for the reminder. So I think it's important for me to start with who I am, the person behind this research, and who did the community needs assessment. So there's this document that you are hopefully familiar with. So this particular piece, we're focusing on education. So I want to mention that I'm the product of an early intervention program. 40 years ago, my parents didn't have a lot of options. They were forced into a particular method, which was the oral approach. And that is a difficult approach for me as an individual who has severe to profound hearing loss. I have zero hearing in either ear. I was born hearing and became deaf when I was 2 from meningitis, and so I have no hearing at all. So throughout my upbringing, I experienced a number of issues that parents of deaf children shared with me via this research as well. I experienced many challenges as a deaf individual in an oral program and in a mainstream program. I went to a hearing school where I was the only deaf individual. And then I went to another program where I was one of 20 deaf and hard of hearing students out of 1,000 in the school itself. And as a result of that, had experiences with bullying and harassment. My family never learned sign language. And even today, when I go and see my family, we use speech and speech reading. And that is a common experience of deaf and hard of hearing children in the state of Oregon. There are many parents who do not know the options that they have available to them and are pushed into choosing one over the other. As I was growing up, I was a brilliant scholar, but I didn't know what I didn't know. How do you know what you don't know if you don't know what you don't know, right? So, throughout college, I learned American Sign Language. And this visual language allowed me to build a bridge of comprehension for the first time in my life when I was in college. And that's when I realized what I had missed until that point. I wish I had had that opportunity earlier on while I was in the early intervention program. So throughout this particular research, I would say that deaf and hard of hearing children are considered at risk, and the early intervention programs are critical for long-term impact. What happens for them at a young age is either can either negatively or positively impact them long-term. Right now, the system is set up in such a way, in terms of what I've collected in the stories from the individuals who talk to me, it seems that we're playing Russian roulette with our deaf and hard of hearing children in Oregon. Meaning, parents are forced to choose a particular route, and if it doesn't work, then the system takes them to another approach. Then, if that doesn't work, it takes them to another approach until they find one that works. They might be 10 by then, by the time they find something that actually works for them, and that delays their language acquisition and their learning. And that has a negative outcome long term. Throughout this study, parents were reporting frustrations with the system, not having a neutral place to learn about the different options that are available. They were pushed into a specific pathway. I'm going to show you four quotes from the focus groups that I had with parents of deaf and hard of hearing children. So here's the first one. The quote says, "We see a lot of deaf children being very isolated. So they're in the neighborhood school, but they're not really integrated into the community because of language barrier. And we're seeing a lot of mental health problems in the deaf community because of isolation. There is significant research available that talks about isolation and mental health issues as a result of isolation, even suicidal tendencies and those kinds of things. So this is a parent of a 7-month-old baby who expressed her frustration with an early intervention program regarding communication, saying, "The early intervention preschool right now, the only preschool that I could get a hold of that had any sign support with a hearing specialist, doesn't get it." The next story is a parent of a hard of hearing child who uses both ASL and spoken language. And they shared, "There's this problem where kids aren't getting language. And I'm not talking about sounds because what I'm seeing is that they're not getting language. And then when they finally get hearing aids on, they're being told to not sign. So there's just this big gap. And for me, that's a huge barrier as children go forward. And I would just like to see the children. I'd like to see babies with lots of language." And then this is a parent of a 5-year-old deaf boy who complained, "When my son was diagnosed as deaf, the early intervention team looked at us and said, 'ASL or oral, you need to pick one, you can't do both.' They said that we would confuse him if we did both ASL and oral. And you look at people who have hearing infants, and they say teach them sign language for teaching them to eat and sleep. But they are telling me I can't do that with my deaf child. You don't know where to get information, but you feel like you're forced to have to make a decision for your child at that stage."
Hi again, I'm Cheryl Davis. I want to reiterate what Denise has said about the child's experience moving through the educational system. Understand that many times the way hearing loss is communicated to the parents and to the child is that they have failed the hearing test. So they've already experienced failure at a young age. And then they get into an educational system where we are doing our best to find out what kind of a system is going to work well for them. But it seems that it's interpreted as if they don't make it in an oral program, or if they don't make it in a mainstream program, they have failed again, and now they're moving into a different setting, like a school for the deaf. So I would like to see deaf and hard of hearing children not experience that much failure at such an early age. And in addition, they're already, if they're already language deprived, then they are going to be challenged at analyzing this information for themselves and making sense of it for themselves and incorporating that into their identities and understanding how to handle this. So I just had a few more comments to add in addition to what Denise had mentioned. There is no reason not to use ASL with children, even if you are planning on focusing on an oral approach. ASL allows a family to immediately have access to helping children make connections, cause and effect, the ability to make requests, the ability to express emotion, to start an internal dialogue, and to have the language to create meaning out of the world around them. Basically, it gives them comprehension. Deaf and hard of hearing and deafblind role models are vital to these children's growth and understanding of their identity and how to perceive the world. One example of this is deaf habitus. And an example of that comes from a fellow faculty member's research in three different countries of how deaf teachers worked with deaf children and how they naturally showed them how to pay attention to the right place, how to get the child's attention, how the children could appropriately get other people's attention, because it's all visual for deaf children. So they have to be looking at the right place to be getting any information. And that seems like a simple concept, but over and over and over again, I see it happen where people are talking and demonstrating something at the same time, and the person can't take both in. So you can have a film that the access that you're providing is captions, and that's great. Or you can provide interpreting for the student, and that's great. But the student needs more than that. The student needs an opportunity to see the video maybe once, maybe twice, to be able to put the two pieces of information together, the demonstration part of it and the explanation part of it. While hearing people take in the world through their eyes and ears, deaf people take it in through visual means, and deafblind people take it in through touch. I had an amazing experience last week in Seattle where I was working with a group of deafblind people who are going through the process of developing a separate language for the deafblind community called protactile. So while ASL is a visual language, protactile uses a lot of ASL, but it does it in a physical, in a touch way. And it was a very interesting experience. One of the things for deafblind people is always be in touch, so that way they know whether you've left the room or not. They know if you're still there. I have, as an example, And this is sort of, this is a cultural piece. So for a deafblind person, if I'm signing and she's feeling what is going on with my hands, you would think that maybe I would sign 1, 2, or 1, 2, and 3, right? But I have to remember she's deaf and blind. And so instead, I'm going to say 1, 2, and 3, because it's a physical thing. So, thank you, Denise. So as sighted hearing people, it's very easy for us to think you know, oh, we can just adjust some of the ways that we do things and it will work for them. And that's it, it disrespects their life experiences. And they are coming up with their own much more meaningful ways and much more effective ways of getting information for themselves. Shifting to hard of hearing children, for hard of hearing children, teachers and classmates must understand the proper use of technology. If the sound isn't coming into the microphone, then their assistive technology is not picking up the sound, and so the child is going to be missing out. And like Denise said about you don't know what you don't know, the child may not, well, I have kids, so I would say may not be motivated or may not know that they're missing something right now. And so people have to be aware and have to understand how to use that technology. There are amplification systems like a sound field system that can help all children and the instructor. So a system like this amplifies the sound in the room so that English language learners, children with ADHD, and those with intermittent hearing losses because of otitis media or ear infections, so that all of these people can pick up the nuance of language much better than having the teacher standing in front of a classroom. Classrooms are notoriously, they have notoriously poor acoustics, which is sort of ridiculous when you think about it, but they do. And for children learning language, they need to be able to pick up all of the nuance. So hard of hearing children, for example, might be missing the endings of words like the pluralizations or the past tenses, and that seems to follow them throughout their lives. By the way, it also saves the strain on the teacher's voice so that she's not trying to speak over other people. There are policies that can prevent some deaf, hard of hearing, and deaf blind people from becoming those role models in education and other fields. Academic institutions might not realize or recognize that the English language challenges caused by standardized testing, even though the test makers, like the GRE, the Graduate Record Examination, says that their tests are not standardized on populations of people with disabilities, so or English language learners and other groups. So without an allowance for an alternative entrance, like a portfolio of skills instead of this written test, people are excluded from higher education. That has a huge impact on our children. It's part of that vicious cycle that we need to correct. So language, communication, education about the world and about the self leads to critical thinking, higher education, jobs, jobs with higher salaries, and hopefully an increased quality of life. It is the most basic civil right, and it has high impact and huge implications for the rest of the individual's life. Denise?
Thank you. So you might be aware that there are upwards of 95% of deaf and hard of hearing children are born to hearing parents, which is a high percentage. And those parents then are not aware of the resources that are available. They don't know where to find the information. So we need a neutral center where parents can explore the options that they have for their children. And that's related to Senate Bill 1018 about establishing a commission for the deaf. Also, early intervention, preschool options at the Oregon School for the Deaf is another recommendation that we would make. Currently, they do not have the option of providing that. And then language acquisition and development, HB 3412, we would emphasize reading this report, the community needs assessment and the data that's there, the quotes from parents, the stories from parents of deaf and hard of hearing children has become documented here for the first time in Oregon. And this is now data, this is evidence, and this is just the tip of the iceberg. There are a lot of other issues that are not included in here because of the time. I had 8 minutes, 8 minutes, 8 months to begin and complete this research project and report on it. So it, given more time, I would collect even more stories, and there would be many more quotes available for us to fill out the picture of what the barriers are and why it is, it's perplexing why we are forcing parents to choose one particular path rather than giving them all the options at a young age that they could have. Because when a child is one, we don't know how they learn yet. They're one. We don't know that until they are older. And we don't know their preferences for learning, whether they learn through written or tactile or auditory methods, any of those kinds of things. They're one. It's not fair to make a choice at one for that level of impact long term. So playing Russian roulette needs to stop. Let's give the kids every possible option available and support parents in that process, in exploring the options available to them. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I know that Chad just showed up, and we've got about 10 minutes for the rest of the presentation. Did you want to say anything? We'll give you 2 minutes.
Great. Great. Again, thank you. Sorry I wasn't here at the very beginning. I was busy in one of the other rooms, and I have not had to deal with things happening simultaneously before, so I apologize for that. So I just wanted to emphasize...
He needs to identify himself for the record.
Oh, my apologies. I'm Chad Ludwig, president of the Oregon Association for the Deaf. I wanted to reemphasize the importance of deaf and hard of hearing education in the state of Oregon. We have 1,050 deaf and hard of hearing kids in the school system right now, and their language development is critical. They're in a critical time for that. There was a recent report that came out of the Oregon Department of Education, and they did a report on kindergarten readiness. And there were a total of 43,000 kids from birth to five. And they had various pass-fail rates on kindergarten readiness. But 54 of those individuals, all of the deaf and hard of hearing ones in that population, all of them failed kindergarten readiness, primarily having to do with language development. So now with the information from the community needs assessment and this ODE report, there is evidence. This is critical. We need to address the language development for young children birth to eight in the state of Oregon. Thanks for your time.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there any questions of the panel? Representative Solman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate you being here today, and I was curious. I also am a school board member with the Hillsboro School Board, and in Hillsboro we have Groner Elementary School that has a deaf and hard of hearing program. It's a partnership with our ESDs, and I was wondering if the ESD connection, is that not all the way across our state that our ESDs are involved with an established program? Is that just something that is particular to this area?
No, sorry. This is Cheryl Davis. There are ESDs across the state.
No, but do they have, and they particularly work this, have a program?
There are regional programs for the deaf across the state.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, that's it. Thank you very much for your presentation. It was very informative. Representative McLean, do you have a question?
Well, that just made me think. So are you saying that they are coordinated with your organization or your school or just with the ESD and the Department of Ed?
Yeah.
So we are with Western Oregon University, and we received a contract to do the community needs assessment. So we are not part of the public education system here in Oregon. We did interviews with parents and with community members across the state and surveyed people across the state to get information directly from the people who are using the services. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay, fine. Any other questions? Any other comments? Okay, well, we appreciate you being here and giving the information. We'll be hearing from you again when we hear House Bill 3412, and looking forward to seeing this, because I worked in the Columbia River Gorge area, and the Wasco County ESD had their deaf and hard of hearing program there. And this was many, many years ago, and they didn't have that many students, but unfortunately they would get more every year. So anyway, it's a very, very good program.
Could I add one more thing now that you're saying that? I do want to make it clear, and I don't know that it was clear from our testimony. In the community needs assessment, we were asked to look for areas of concern. We were asked to look for issues, and we were given very, very little time, so we did not take on any additional responsibilities just for the heck of it. So while you hear us talking about what some of the concerns were, we want to make it clear that we are not criticizing any particular schools or districts, nothing like that. We are just concerned about the process.
Yeah, I didn't get that idea.
Okay, good. Thank you. I just wanted to make sure that was clear.
No, that was made very clear. It was just the idea there are different ways to assess children and have them go on their, you know, to decide various ways that they want to learn how to communicate. And it needs to start at a young age.
Right. No. Before that window of language learning closes.
Absolutely. Okay, well, thank you so very much, and we look forward to seeing you guys again.
Thank you.
Okay, so with that, I close the informational hearing on the educational programs for the deaf and hard of hearing students. And do we need a minute or two to shut things down or not? Jack here? Okay. If not, we will open up a public hearing on HJR 28. So, Lethe, if you want to talk about it, then we'll hear from Representative Noble.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, HJR 28 proposes an amendment to the Constitution to require the Legislative Assembly appropriate money which is sufficient to pay for public education from grades kindergarten through grades 12, and it requires the Legislative Assembly to appropriate the money prior to any budget bill. There is a subsequent referral to rules, and it may have a fiscal impact, but there's no impact issued, and it may have a revenue impact. Impact, but no impact issued at this time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Wilson, and members of the community, my name is Ron Noble. I'm the state representative for House District 24, which is McMinnville up through Hillsboro, and I'm here to talk about funding education. Before you is a referral to the voters. It's a constitution amendment for the people that will require the legislature every regular session in an odd number year to appropriate funding for public education before appropriating money for any other budget bills that come before the legislature. HJR 28 places the question before the voters of Oregon as to whether we're going to make funding to education a priority in this state. As a percentage of general funds and lottery funds, Oregon's K through 12 education budget has decreased from 44.7% during the 2003 to 2005 biennium to a total of 38.1% proposed in our current Ways and Means Co-Chairs framework. If the 17-19 Co-Chairs framework K-12 budget were maintained to the same percentage level of funding from 2003 to 2005, there would be an additional $1.3 billion headed to public schools. And I'm very aware of the budget gap that we face, even in times of record revenue. However, we still, even though it's improving, have the third worst graduation rate in the country. And as recently as 2015, the state estimated that 94,000 Oregon students are chronically absent from school, which greatly jeopardizes the chance of these students graduating on time or graduating at all. In 1999, the state legislative assembly approved the quality education model. Yet we have not once funded the quality education model. Expecting the same results, providing the same bar, yet average funding is 70% to 75% of what it would take to actually achieve the quality education model, and that's consistent with what we're looking at this next year. I am, as I mentioned, very aware of our budget constraints, and I also know that our general fund and lottery funds generally deal with education, human services, and public safety. I would suggest, even though I have a background in public safety and I sit on the Human Services Committee, that, and I will probably take a little heat from this, that both human services
and will protect you.
Very good, very good. Human services and public safety are generally a reaction to where we are today. Yet investing in K through 12 will determine where we are tomorrow. I know that we predict in public safety, be it prisons or future needs from first responders, what's going on in the schools is what will predict what our needs are in prisons. And I'm pretty sure that that works the same way with DHS and what their social needs and what their issues are going to be next year, the 5 years or 10 years. And until we actually get serious and fund the schools the way they need to be funded, we will continually deal with these same issues. I'm just suggesting that we need to get serious and make priorities and put the money that's going to change the future. So maybe the outcomes of what's necessary for DHS or public safety change. That's my testimony. That's the whole purpose of the bill. There is a similar bill in the Senate, I want the discussion.
I'm sure.
Comments, Representative McClain.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for coming in front of the committee and for having that as one of your top goals, if not your top goal, because I know I feel the same way. And so what I'm trying to figure out when I'm looking at the bill, if that allows us to have, you know, that happen on a regular biennium, you know, planning basis. Last year we did that. We went ahead and we took what we could, you know, and we talked about the amount on the budget for education, and I believe it was April when we actually got a chance to vote on it. But it was a situation where this year we've had, we have a reaction of having not just a budget gap, but also we're trying to figure out, you know, what possible other funds are out there in both March and May as we look at the economic indicators. And so my question to you is, does this only allow you to do it first and then it's closed off to any more discussion, or is it something that would be fluid like it can be in the present situation?
Chair Doherty, Representative McClain, I believe that this is the beginning of the discussion, and I know the discussion has begun already.
Okay.
But it's my part.
Okay.
And I think there are things we need to think about. Quite honestly, most of the school district superintendents and school boards are concerned that first funding isn't always best funding. Mm-hmm. So that's a discussion as well. Mm-hmm. And the chance to go back. In the interest of total disclosure, logistically, I don't think it works to pick out parts of the budget. It needs to be a package. But I think we need to figure out what the priorities are, mm-hmm. so that our kids mm-hmm. have a better life, and that the funds for DHS and public safety don't keep growing at the expense of education, because we're dealing with the problems today as opposed to trying to solve tomorrow's problems.
Representative Vile.
Madam Chair, Representative Noble, I'm focused on the word adequate in line 6 of the bill. And I'm just wondering if there's been any thought given to how we might define adequate, so that when we did decide we were going to do this, I like the idea, we had a baseline to start with.
Chair Doherty, Representative Vile, I think that is the question. That's the question I think that we all deal with right now, and how we define record revenues, yet record expenditures. And adequate, is that just the amount of money, or are there efficiencies and money directed in certain areas that also provides that adequacy? It has to be adequate. Definition, I think, is going to take all of us to figure that out. Again, to say with the same thing, it's just we have to make it a priority to do that.
Okay, Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Noble, I also want to say thanks for bringing this forward. Not that long ago, I was suggesting the quality education model is the target we should be aiming for, as opposed to some numbers that we won't mention today. But the fact that making it a priority for conversation, not just about what adequate is, but the interconnection between, by not funding it, the opportunity cost downrange, is something that I think many people know here, but they haven't quite gotten here yet. And I'm hoping that because of your piece of legislation and ongoing conversation across the aisle, we can come to a consensus about why it's not just the right thing to do for the kids, which it is, but it's also the right thing to do for the long term and the next generation of kids and the following generation of kids. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions, Representative Parrish?
Thanks for bringing it. I think it's important. We actually, my first year, we funded the education budget first. It was the first bill out the door. So we know how to do this. The question I have is that by putting it in the Constitution, do we create future potential challenges via the courts or Washington State has language in their Constitution that has certainly driven expensive court cases around education funding. So do we put ourselves in a similar predicament by enshrining something like this in the Constitution? And if we fail to meet that objective, somehow potentially open ourselves up to very expensive litigation?
Chair Doherty, Representative Parrish, I think that possibility is there. But as I campaign this year, school funding in schools is one of the top priorities. Sure. So either we collectively, myself included, figure this out, or I think we're going to end up with a constitutional amendment anyway.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Just kind of as a comment, in the 35 years that I worked with schools, 25 of them working intimately with school budgets, the one thing about schools is at this point in time, which is only almost April 1st, is that budgets have already been developed in K-12 schools. And the reason is at this point, one of the no matter what business you are, personnel is one of the largest factors, is that they already have to go through and figure out how many teachers they need, how many instructional assistants, how many bus drivers, how many cooks, all of that kind of thing. And it's based on estimating what's going to happen next year and also estimating what the funding will now. I mean, 30 years ago it was different, but now it's the idea of how much money we're going to get from the state. So the idea of having it early and having it, so at least a figure is something that's very helpful for planning of schools, because right now all the temporary teachers are being laid off, and the first-year teachers are probably been given notice that their positions may not be around next year because they have certain obligations that they have to let people know when they're going. So I think the idea of doing it early and doing it first is commendable. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just say my previous political experience in the last century lapsing into this one was that of education being funded at the very last moment. Mm-hmm. And that was a real miserable situation. It was a terrible situation. So I am a great proponent for having it earlier rather than later.
Because I know the one year that we did do it early, it was almost like school district superintendents were able to go and say, at least we know that we have this. There may be more, many less, and that they could go through and plan their budgets for the next year, because they have to be done by June 1st at the very, very latest. Okay, Representative.
I don't disagree with anything that was just said, but I do want to tell you what I was told, at least by one of my two districts, and that is, I said, do you want the number that they're looking at now, or do you want more than that number? And what they said is, we want more than that number. And they also indicated that they have three budgets.
Yeah.
And so there's a low, medium, and high budget as far as the low is going to go with the number that they've already heard. Mm-hmm. And the medium is, hopefully hold the course. Mm-hmm. And then the high budget is going to definitely be, if we get the quality education model actually, funded. But I don't think there's anybody up here, and I know that there are at least two of us that have worked on work groups and worked on legislation that says quality education model, are we serious? I don't know if I agree that it has to always be first, because I think sometimes that we need to make sure we're thorough and or we're looking for efficiencies and overlapping of dollars and overlapping of budgets and overlapping of programs. And so I want it to be done well. And so I'm not always sure that it's a complicated budget and there's a lot of elements to it, including what we give to siloed programs in the Department of Ed. So it's not just their budgets or how much money we're going to give to them through the actual per pupil funding, but it's also what we give to other folks that are actually supposed to be supporting those public schools and charter schools and online virtual schools and other schools that have our students in it. Mm-hmm. So I'm out on thinking time.
on if it's so important to have it done first, but I'm right with you as far as the quality education model and making sure we do it in the very best possible prioritized way.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate Representative McLean your comments. I think a lot of times in our society, first means it's the priority.
Okay.
And when I was talking to school district superintendents about their budgets and the three different levels that they're looking at and how they've come down, there's a concern that they won't be able to negotiate.
Yeah.
And they won't be able to plead their case. I think it actually says a lot that we put them in a position to have to do that as opposed to spend time actually teaching our children. That's part of the process, and I understand that, but at some point we're going to have to figure out a way to make it a priority. I'm hoping that this will start us taking it serious so that the work you do here in this committee actually can build off of that as opposed to always trying to figure out what and how you're going to make it stretch.
Right. Thank you.
Hey, Representative Solman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say that I really appreciate your, you know, the idea of prioritizing and really bringing this to the forefront of the conversation. I share the concerns that as Representative McLean brought up about the first out the door, because I can tell you from a district in Hillsboro that since 2008 we've cut $70 million from our budget. And if you look at that first number that comes out the door and you say, okay, that's what we have to go for, then all of a sudden, if you do have to start making that plan to develop the pink slips and whatnot, and then all of a sudden they come back and they give you more money, then you have to take back that. That becomes extremely difficult for a school budget process. But I have to say that I commend Hillsboro for what they do for their outreach, for their budget process involving the community. But it is a sad state that we've come to, that we have every year then to tell our school districts to prepare for that. If your funding comes here, if your funding comes there, if your funding comes there, and really work their time around those. So I appreciate your focus on being proactive versus reactive, because that's hitting the nail right there, is really making sure that we prioritize education first and foremost. So
thank you.
And the sad thing is this is not a new phenomenon.
No.
When I was laid off the first day I taught in 1974 because we had no operating levy, and actually I was laid off 3 years in a row along with 850 other people. So anyway, I think we need to start getting serious, and this is a good start. So I appreciate you very much for bringing this to us.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Okay, you're welcome. Okay, with that, I close the public hearing on HJR 28 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3340. If you could introduce the bill.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, House Bill 3340 requires the Department of Education to prepare written materials regarding opportunities to work as an apprentice in the state of Oregon. It requires the Department of Education provide written materials on apprenticeship programs to public high schools in Oregon, and it requires their distribution of materials when high schools provide higher education information to students. There is a -1 amendment on OLIS which removes the requirement that the materials provided by the department are in written form and allows for electronic or print material.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hurd, would you like
to
speak on your bill, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to come testify on my bill, and thank you for being a sponsor on the bill as well, and thank you to the rest of the committee. My name is Dallas Hurd. I am the representative from House District 2, which is primarily Roseburg, down to just north of Grants Pass along the I-5 corridor, so great folks. House Bill 3340 is a simple bill. It simply is going to be promoting CTE and apprenticeship in Oregon high schools. There's a tremendous need for skilled labor right now in Oregon's workforce. This building that we all work in every day would not be possible without the individuals that have gone through the apprenticeship programs and then go into the skilled labor workforce. The nice thing about a lot of this industry is that when you transfer from high school to the apprenticeship programs or from wherever you are into the apprenticeship programs, most of, if not all of, the education is already paid for. And so it's my belief that while we're experiencing near record highs in dropout rates in high school, that this bill could potentially have a positive impact on having young people refocus themselves into going into the skilled labor force. If you're an individual like myself who doesn't necessarily like the classroom, I did not go to college, it's a difficult place sometimes to feel like you've got a real purpose going to school every day. For myself, half the time the only reason I kept going to school is because I was playing varsity sports. And I had good parents that kept me on track as well. My belief is that there's a lot of young people that their mind is wired the way mine is, which is I do things with my hands, and that's what I'm passionate about. That's what I'm good at. I learn quickly through that skill set, whereas reading a book or listening to someone else talk is quite difficult for me at times. Just, I don't know if it's because it's boring or what have you, but I think, there we go.
Hello, sir. Sorry to interrupt.
Nice to have you. I think it's going to have a great impact on Oregon's young people as far as getting them to stay with the schooling, because now they're going to know that, hey, there is lucrative job opportunities out there with good benefits, with an opportunity for them to do something other than just sit in a classroom because they're not interested in going to college. And that's fine. We need people to build these buildings. We need people to do plumbing. We need people to weld, to work on heavy equipment, diesel engines. Oregon skilled trades deserve their place of respect in our school system, and that's what I'm trying to do here with this bill, along with my colleague, chief co-sponsor here. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to him.
Thank you, sir. Good afternoon, committee. I feel like I know you all from somewhere. My name is Representative Chris Gorsuch. I am from District 49, which is East Multnomah County. So Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Wilson, Vice Chair Hernandez.
He's not here.
Yeah.
He's kind
not
of class.
Here. And and the committee. I'm here today in support also of House Bill 3340. This bill basically directs BOLI, in conjunction with the Department of Education, to expand on an existing collaboration on career education awareness, which informs high school students about apprenticeships and CTE internships. This will allow counselors and other school-sponsored mentors to inform students and parents during career days about the many lucrative opportunities that are available in the skilled trades, along with the discussion about higher education, which I'm sure my colleague has already spoken to you about. In my district, we do have a number of these types of jobs that sit open, just waiting for people with the right qualifications to come along and step into those spots. Having the opportunity to expand awareness is just another way we can make sure that young people looking for living wage jobs are aware of these very important opportunities. So CTE and apprenticeship 3340 promotes these programs in the following ways. It ensures that during career days and college prep events that guidance counselors will have information about BOLI certified local apprenticeships. It helps to promote filling the many jobs that are being created and also vacated, we need to remember that as well, by a previous generation of skilled crafts women and men who are retiring. And it provides a real connection for young people that might not otherwise be aware that excellent career opportunities can be had outside of conventional higher education. I also understand that the Dash 1 amendment is a technical fix that clarifies the term written, so that that includes both printed and electronic materials. And I can tell you, in my experiences at the community college at Mount Hood, we serve both kinds of students. We serve students that are college prep. We also serve a lot of students that are career technical. And many times, they will only have to take a small amount of education to qualify for many of those career technical jobs that are out there, 2 years rather than four or more. So these sorts of opportunities are extremely important, and I believe that this is a very, very necessary bill, and anything that we can do to get that information out is a good thing. So thank you, committee, and I can answer any questions.
May I add one more? Thank you, Madam Chair. One more just piece of real information from back in my district. You know, we've got some different projects that are coming down the pike soon. that are going to require a lot of welding, a lot of different skilled trade labor, and we have almost no one to fill those high paying job opportunities. It's going to have to all be shipped in from somewhere else. I want us to get ahead of this and get our own young people and just our folks in general ready for the job, and let's make some money. You know, let's get some careers going. So, questions, comments, insults?
Any questions?
Only for Representative Wilson.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know I have a question. I wanted to appreciate you bringing up the comments about a lot of the two-year programs. Mm-hmm. And there was an example recently that was shared through Clean Water Services through local area in Hillsboro. So there was a 2 or 3 year program that kids could go through and at the end could make $70,000.
Yes. Yeah.
And so I was wondering, do you have connections with this program, with the school to, I don't know if all chambers have a school to career program. I know in Hillsboro they do, but it is a great way. I was just wondering if you are aware of that. And also, I really hear Measure 98 in this. Mm-hmm. So have you, you know, had some connections, conversations around ability, you know, to...
I have not.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
No, nor have I. I do know, though, that if you think about companies like Boeing, they're very interested... because they can do internships with students that are doing, like, welding and other things and tie them right into it, the potential for a really good job. So it's kind of similar to what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's kind of, to me, this is just a beginning because it's getting the written information out so they know
right.
that there are welders and plumbers and mm-hmm. steam fitters and all of these sort of things. But then hopefully it will move into something of a partnership with the unions and partnerships with organizations
right.
and go from there.
And, Madam Chair, I think that you're absolutely right. And a lot of times people don't know that those jobs are out there.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, going to the high school level. Is a really good. I have an 18-year-old who's finishing up actually his high school at Mount Hood, and he's not terribly excited about going on to 4 years, but he's really into a lot of like mechanical things and the potential for flying and a bunch of other things. So, for that kind of kid, this is a much better fit.
Well, as I say, I taught North Clackamas that has had their occupational skills center for since the 60s. And it, first of all, it kept kids in school, but we had a lot of students that would get out, and they were doing these programs, and we were working with the unions. And 2 years after they got out of high school, they were making more money than we were.
Yes.
So, and the best thing about it is they're still doing it, and they're in their 50s. So, mm-hmm. but they're ready to retire, so we need to get new folks.
And we face a whole bunch of people that are getting ready to retire, and that's the other piece to this.
Mm-hmm. And Madam Chair, it wasn't too long ago I was in high school, and I don't recall.
Yeah, me too. I was 5 years.
Yeah. Oh, boy. You keep telling yourself that.
in dog years. Right?
The mirror says otherwise, but I'm going to keep telling myself it wasn't too long ago.
Yeah.
But there was none of this information put in front of me.
No.
Never.
No, great idea.
And one last thing. People don't realize how, like you were talking about, people don't realize how important these jobs are and how well they pay.
Yeah.
There's a real disconnect in terms of people going, you just build things, and you're just a welder.
Yeah. Does it pay better than this job?
I think it does.
Yeah.
Wow.
They have benefits and a retirement program.
What?
Yes.
Oh.
So anyway, any other questions? Thank you very much. We have some other folks to testify on this.
Thanks.
And so we'll bring up Joel Fisher, Tim Frew, and Ryan Tribbett.
Sir? I was supposed to start it. Sure.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tim Frew. I'm the Executive Secretary of the Oregon State Building Trades. I represent 28,000 skilled trades unionists, and we have approximately 21 affiliates, which have 16 apprenticeship programs. I'm the graduate of a 4-year apprenticeship program 30 years ago, 30-year pin. Pretty proud of that. And as a result of coming through the IBEW apprenticeship, I was able to provide for my family, even though sometimes, you know, in construction, you've got the lean times, but you got to be prepared for that. But when I was in high school, the train of thought was that you're going to a 4-year college. No, that was a few years ago, sorry to admit, but that was the mindset. And so I bounced around. I went to Florida State University for a while, went and tried to do a couple other things, went to junior college, and then finally I joined the Navy, where I became an electrician's mate. And after I got out of the Navy, I kind of bumped around with some residential electrical contractors and ended up going from Arizona back to Florida. And a buddy of mine that I was in high school with, he was in the IBEW apprenticeship. And he says, "What are you doing?" "Well, if you're in the Navy as an electrician, why don't you do this?" That was the best thing I ever did in my life. You know, but the thing of it is, and we're seeing that today, is that there's still, we're kind of like the best kept secret as far as our apprenticeship program. But the word is getting out because we're actively pursuing young people, whether it's through CTE, pre-apprenticeship programs, to come into our local unions and our apprenticeship. Where else can you have a young person that has the opportunity to earn while they learn and they're not saddled with debt after they top out of their 3, 4, 5 year apprenticeship program? And to your point, yeah, they're making pretty darn good money, mm-hmm. and they've got a pension, and they've got health care where they can provide for their family. So for those reasons, that's why I'm in support of House Bill 3340. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, Ryan Tribbett here today on behalf of the National Electrical Contractors Association. And, you know, I'm not going to repeat things that others had said. I mean, but I can't count how many times I've been to one of our training centers and talk to the apprentices when we do that. We go on tours with legislators, and we always try to introduce them to the apprentices. And in those conversations, it seems like almost every time we talk with one of the apprentices, we'll say, "I had no idea these programs were out here. I went through 2 years of college, 4 years of college, and in many cases sort of got saddled with debt before they even realized that they weren't happy with what they were learning. They weren't happy with what that career path was taking them. And then, only then did they learn through someone that they talked to about the IBEW program and then go through it that way." And as Tim said, you know, it is, we do call it earn while you learn. We don't saddle our people with debt. And it's just unfortunate that so many people spend so much time going down a path that if they had just known about this sooner, that they could have done that, gone that way in the first place. So we think it's it's not a big bill in the grand scheme of this session or a complicated one, but I think it will be great in its impact to the people that it does impact. So we urge your support for it, and thank you for hearing.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Fisher on behalf of Oregon Business Association and Associated Oregon Industries. A lot of good things have been said. Just want to kind of tie a bow on it and point out students often end up in a job that they know about, typically from what their parents have done or what they know and is popular, right? Doctor, lawyer, teacher, fireman, policeman. And what this bill is a recognition of is that we need to do a better job of providing a really wide range of job experiences to students, because they can't be something that they just don't know about. You know, go ask any student if they know what an electrician is or an engineer is, and if their family member isn't one of them, it might not be something that they're thinking about. So happy to be here supporting this bill. We think it's good work. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, this panel? Okay, thank you, gentlemen, very much. So we have Gabby Nunley, Emily Nazarov, and Paloma Sparks.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, my name is Emily Nazarov. I'm the legislative coordinator with the Department of Education, and I brought one of my colleagues, Gabby Nunley, to talk about what is currently happening in this area.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty and members of the House Education Committee. For the record, my name is Gabby Nunley, and I'm an education specialist for work-based learning and an apprenticeship liaison for the Department of Education. I also represent the Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development at the Higher Education Coordinating Commission and liaison with the Bureau of Labor and Industries Apprenticeship Training Division. I'm here today to provide information on existing government agency methods for informing the public about Oregon apprenticeship and to provide some context for the Dash 1 amendment for this bill. The Apprenticeship Training Division at the Bureau of Labor and Industries has two websites which connect the end user with apprenticeship opportunities, frequently asked questions, apprenticeship standards, upcoming apprenticeship events open to the public, and much more. In addition to the agency website, there is an apprenticeship community website, which provides clarity around youth apprenticeship, pre-apprenticeship opportunities, and where to locate local trade training centers. The Secondary and Post-Secondary Transitions Unit, in partnership with the Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, have web links to the aforementioned websites, frequently asked questions and answer documents for the field, and presentation materials for school counselors, teachers, and administrators to support college and career-ready activities with students and their parents. The proposed Dash 1 amendment would allow the department to prepare or create more awareness around the already created materials in print or in electronic form. The secondary and post-secondary transition team has had experience in distributing materials to the career and technical education field and network with varying levels of success. We have found that distributing hard copy materials to our CTE programs are met with various challenges in capacity to deliver materials. The distribution of materials to students and their parents does not ensure that they actually read them or actually get them, and the use of those materials thereafter. Furthermore, the development, print, and labor costs can be quite intensive. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you. Paloma?
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, Paloma Sparks, the Bureau of Labor and Industries. As Gabby outlined, we work closely with Department of Education to try and get as much students as much exposure to career and technical education, shop classes, apprenticeship opportunities. Years ago, the starting age of an average apprentice was 19. It's now 28. Part of that is that we have stepped too far away from exposing students to the opportunities in the trades, in apprenticeship. So the Bureau is committed to expanding career and technical education and working closely with any and all partners to notify students of their opportunities outside of just the four-year university.
Thank you. Are there any questions at this point? Yeah, Emily, did you have anything else to say?
No, I'm just here to introduce. Provide support.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Solman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to say that I look at this opportunity as like a step one, and I hear that, you know, that you're doing so much. I met with somebody,
Stephen Sims, Director of Leadership Training Division.
Right. That was really excited about having that conversation about the apprenticeship opportunity. But I look at this, you do provide the material, but there is that missing link that we're not getting it to parents, and kids aren't seeing the opportunity. So I would love to see more career opportunity days, within our schools, an organized front, to really show kids what opportunities are out there. I know my son is what Representative Hurd described, 20-year-old who wanted to just get down and work in his with his hands. He went to a trade school, and he is loving what he's doing. So, but he didn't realize that because in school it was all about where are you going to college, and he was pretty frustrated about that. So he's not a unique story, and I really just want to say I really feel like if we want to address our graduation rate, if we want to address so much about issues that we're facing with workforce, these are the types of things that get kids inspired and excited. And so I just want more opportunity for them. So I don't know if you have a career awareness time, or idea planned, or partnerships with the chamber too.
Chair Doherty, Representative Solman, thank you for your comment. In your district in particular, with Hillsborough and that county, you do have a school to work coordinator who is able to facilitate actual apprenticeship trades career events for your students.
Okay.
We would love to be able to see that statewide.
Yes.
And I do believe that, well, for what is already existing out there with union apprenticeship coordinator events along with non-union events. There's construction day, career fair events. We would like to have that statewide, and that might be an option instead of written and electronic materials. That is definitely an awareness piece, but what you're talking about is more of a planned coordinated event that that provides hands-on training, applied learning, exercises, and interaction within the union and non-union representatives, and actually getting that face-to-face time versus being mixed in within a career fair with other careers and things like that. If we had that opportunity, we would try to do that.
Okay.
And so we support that as well.
Okay, thank you very much. Anything else?
Okay, with that, that's all that we have signed up, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3340. And actually, we're going to open a work session on House Bill 3352. And with this is at the request of the Speaker's Office, we're moving House Bill 3352 to the House Committee on Health Care.
Oh.
So, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Doherty, I move House Bill 3352, and without recommendation to the Committee on House Health Care, with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Joint Ways and Means by prior reference.
Okay, so Representative Wilson moves House Bill 3352 without recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on House Health Care with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Joint Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Since we haven't heard the bill. Since there's no other discussion, could the clerk read the roll, please? Matt?
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative McLean?
Aye.
Representative Parrish?
Aye.
Representative Solman?
Aye.
Representative Springer?
Excused.
Representative Vile?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hernandez?
Excused.
Vice Chair Wilson?
Aye.
Chair Doherty?
Aye. Okay, with that, the motion passes, and the bill is sent to the Committee on House Health Care. Okay, so with that, I close the work session on House Bill 3352 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2997. Representative Smith. Yes, if Aletheia, could you introduce the bill, please?
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, House Bill 2997 requires that anyone having control of children ages between the ages of 6 and 18 years who are found in violation of not sending their children to school shall have half the collected fine sent to the school district or education service district and the other half sent to either the state of Oregon, county, or city that established the court. There is no revenue impact on this bill, and it has a minimal fiscal impact.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith. I have the distinct pleasure of representing District 57, which includes Umatilla County, Morrow County, Gillum County, Sherman County, and the very, very best parts of Wasco County. Madam Chair, you just never know where legislation is going to come to you from. So one Wednesday night, I've got my sweats on and my dance shoes on, and I'm preparing for Dancing with the Stars in Hermiston, Oregon, when a constituent comes up to me and says, "Do I have an idea for you?" And at first I was like, I'm kind of focused on this dancing here, but talk to me. That's truly where this bill came from. So, Madam Chair, what House Bill 2997 does is it recognizes that hardworking folks in our K-12 public education system are not being rewarded for much of the hard work they're doing trying to ensure regular attendance in our schools. As you folks know, any person with a child age 6 to 18 is required to maintain the child in regular attendance in school. And should they not do this, they could be found in violation of ORS 339.020. And should they be found guilty of that, they could face a minimum fine of $80. Well, when that fine of $80 is assessed, that money actually goes into our public safety system, of which none of it goes into our school system. And so my good constituent, who is a member of the Oregon School Employees Association, said, that's just not fair. Quite often, we're doing all the work, Wouldn't it be reasonable if half that fine amount was returned back to the school district in which the work occurred? Madam Chair, I am not an expert in public education, and I don't even pretend to know the amount of hard work that goes into collecting these dollars into making sure our children remain in regular attendance. But it did seem reasonable to me that if the school folks are doing the work, okay, that perhaps a portion of the dollars ought to be returned back to the school district. And so that is why I've introduced House Bill 2997.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Vile.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, any idea what we're talking about in terms of dough here?
Madam Chair, Representative Vile, I have to believe it's going to be pretty nominal. I think this is almost more out of principle than out of revenue generation. But should this bill move forward, I can assure you we'll work with the Revenue Committee to figure out what that amount would be. But I do think, Madam Chair, it's almost more symbolic.
Any other questions? I think it's a great idea. Anytime we can generate even a little bit of money is a good thing. And then for those of you that are watching, if I'm sure they could Google Rep. Smith Dancing with the Stars.
Really? It would be very awkward.
And you can see his ability, and that's why he does this every day.
That is correct. Although if any of you would like to see the trophy, come on up to the House office, and we'll show it to you.
Yes, he did win.
Yeah, awkwardly. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, anyone else to testify on House Bill 2997? Okay, if not, I close the public hearing on House Bill 2997. We were going to work it today, but since we have two members that are absent, we'll wait until next week to go through and work this bill and a couple of others. So with that, do we have any other business? Okay, oh my heavens, 4:15. With that, I close the House Education. Okay, oh my heavens, 4:15. With that, I close the House Education.